is to be considered for the IRP, so that specifically consolidated solar power technology is not excluded from the IRP. So that's the agenda for today. I'm going to briefly discuss who STARSAI is, what is concentrated solar power, and what advantages it can provide for our grid in South Africa. I'll provide some summary statements, the assumptions in the IRP, just transition, global status of CSP. I'll discuss the constraints that we've experienced with the procurement of CSP to date, advantages, the cost of CSP, and the way forward. So I will try and provide a holistic view in terms of the technology and see how we can then ensure that the IRP allows for its inclusion. Firstly, STARSAI is the Solar Thermal Association of Southern Africa. It has been established by key international and local companies, you can see the logos on the screen. Companies with big balance sheets, companies that go into countries, take a forward-looking view, 20 to 30-year view of the country, and then invest in terms of development and in power projects. The association, which I chair, and I do have one of my board members here today, Mr. Nandabula, sitting just behind me, and our mandate is to represent concentrated solar power technologies and its advantages in terms of the ability to dispatch the technology, its ability to have direct storage, and its ability to provide for a stable operation of our grid. Those companies listed there are some of the members of the association, and not only have they invested in the country in terms of developing projects going forward, but they also have operating concentrated solar power plants in South Africa and internationally as well. Chair, let me take this opportunity to firstly, you know, say a word in terms of the Department of Energy and the way the IRP has been modeled. You know, firstly, you know, congratulations to them. Modeling any piece of, you know, legislation or a network is a very difficult task. And coming up with a set of assumptions and technologies to produce an integrated resource plan is not an easy task. And I think, you know, we as potential independent power producers, investors, et cetera, we appreciate that good work. So today's task in terms of concentrated solar power is to kind of help the DOE with certain key elements of CSP that was excluded from the modeling process. So firstly, thanks to them. You know, the CSP Association and their members will always be there to support the Department of Energy in terms of its policies and the way they procure these projects. So in this summary slide, I'm going to kind of give you my key talking points for today, and then I will motivate each one as I go forward. I think it's very important as South Africans, you know, we need to make sure that we stimulate economic growth in our country. And in the past, we did this very, very well, where we had surplus cheap power. So which means, you know, big business came and invested in South Africa. We had large smelters, you know, manufacturing sectors, et cetera. One of, you know, the concerns is that the IRP cannot be driven in terms of, you know, waiting for 12,600 megawatts of ESCOM to be power to be decommissioned. So we have to take a different view and say, how do we create an integrated resource plan that can stimulate economic growth rather than the other way? You know, we follow what the demand will be. So we have to have slightly different thinking in terms of these plans we want to put for our future. I also want to raise the point that the integrated resource plan has to not only consider the least cost of energy in its determination of its technology mix, but it has to look at what the National Development Plan says. It has to be very sensitive to the whole just and equitable transition in the energy space. We have to look at our emission commitments and how that power is procured from the IRP. So if we're looking at least cost of energy, Chair, you know, we have to see how does the consumer, how does the end user benefit. We also have to factor, you know, how do we ensure that the South African grid remains stable? Do we have sufficient baseload power? Do we have sufficient mid-merit power? And do we have sufficient peakers to make sure that whenever there's demand on our network, we have sufficient power plants to meet that demand? What I didn't see in the IRP is when technologies are listed in an IRP, you know, they become the status quo, and that's how they get procured in South Africa. We've seen that in the previous rounds. So it's very important that the IRP kind of aligns itself to how those technologies are procured. So if you come too prescriptive in the IRP about any technology, then that's how that technology will be procured. I'll explain a little further going forward. And then also, you know, we'd like to ask the DOE to consider, instead of procuring, you know, just only technology basis, you know, we want so much of wind, so much of PV, so much of gas, and so much of other technology, but kind of consider, you know, how much of energy is needed during our baseload period, how much of energy is needed during our peaking periods, which is in the when the sun is not shining, and in the mid-merit, and then allow the procurement to be done on that basis. We need so much of energy in this period, can the IPPs come and now procure? And this will allow competition and also innovation in technology. Because it's important, you know, the DOE, unfortunately, cannot model every single technology option. And they have to make a call in terms of the assumptions, which we respect. But again, you know, they should not be excluding technologies. So the IRP should consider that, and it should consider factors like fuel costs. You know, there's certain technologies like gas, for instance, that is highly sensitive to our rand-dollar exchange. We see what's happening in the fuel prices right now, so we need to take protection over that. And very important, you know, the system and the grid requirements. So I want to quickly just mention what is concentrated solar power. It is technology that uses the energy from the sun that's able to absorb the energy from the sun in various form, in various what we refer to as heat transfer fluids. It's able to absorb the energy in molten salts, in oil, or even water, which becomes steam. And by doing this, you are able to store energy from the sun. So renewables is able to do that right now. And basically, this plant becomes a fully dispatchable plant. So it doesn't only generate power when the sun is shining. It can generate power 24 hours a day because of its ability to extract the energy using molten salts or oil. So basically, you will heat up the molten salts to about 600 degrees Celsius. You will store that in tanks, and then you would turn that into steam generation. So concentrated solar power technology uses the sun as a fuel and then steam turbine generators as the generating part. Very important with CSP technology is that it's able to do constant generation. So if a cloud comes over the power plant, the power doesn't drop. And if you have been you know, signed up to generate 100 megawatts, you're able to generate 100 megawatts constantly. So concentrated solar power is slightly different from other technologies like your wind and your PV that do direct generation that will generate when the sun shines and the wind blows. We are able to generate 24 hours, so we are able to generate baseload power. So there's various technologies, and it's a very important point because, you know, CSP has different ways of converting the sun's energy. We have parabolic trough technology, we have molten salt tower technologies. It's basically a 200-meter high tower with a boiler sitting on the top. And your mirrors focus your energy on the top of the tower, and then you're able to heat your molten salts to 600 degrees Celsius. You know, so you have large-scale generation that can go into the grid using the technology, and you can use distributed generation, you know, like you said earlier. So this diagram shows basically what happens. You know, you've got your collective field, which is mirrors. So basically, you're reflecting the energy from the sun on the top of a 200-meter high tower. And in that tower, you have salt or oil or steam that's passed through there, and you heat that to 600 degrees Celsius. Then those salts go into a tank, and that's where they start. So which means you can dispatch this plant whenever you want. And you dispatch it using steam turbine generators, and that's exactly what we use in the coal-powered plants. And I'll tell you why I'm making that point later on. And this is just a different configuration. You know, you can use trucks to do the same thing. So you have different types of collectors that's able to collect the energy from the sun. Now, very important, and this is something we have to consider in the IRP as well, is this just transition to a low carbon economy? And we're seeing it internationally. A lot of countries, a lot of governments are putting in policy to support renewable energy. We're seeing disinvestments in fossil fuel technologies. But I think what we need to do is make sure we, as a country, adopt this up front. There's going to be a period where transition to low carbon economy results in some job losses. But if we adopt this very early, then technologies like CHP, which is premised on the back of steam turbine generators, are able to then take on those jobs. You know, you don't have to do a lot of reskilling, etc. So you're able to then to manage this transition into this new economy. There is also industry that we can continuously support, jobs we can support, and we can create new skills and new jobs as well. So just transition, we're going to the low economy, we're seeing that, and it also now brings in new cutting-edge technology into generation mixes. And I think this is the one point we'd like to make to the DOE, is that you cannot model the IRP only on low cost of energy. You have to model it looking how we protect the other important characteristics in the country in terms of job creation, industry creation, etc. Now, when you procure such technologies, the competitive bidding will take care of the cost to make sure it is done on a low-cost basis. So globally, there's a massive uptake for renewable energy. We've seen the pricing of wind and PV come down drastically. CSP is at a stage where it is the fastest technology in terms of learning curves and the reduction of costs. If you look at the next one, there's a massive uptake of CSP internationally. We look at places like China, for instance, who have a 1,000-megawatt demonstration project, 1,000 megawatts. All right, and I'll give you some context to those numbers just now. So CSP internationally there's a massive uptake for the technology, and you know, they've seen the overall benefits in terms of no links to FX, in terms of fuel pricing, etc., and the other benefits the technology can produce in terms of its localization. So let's look at the IRP very quickly, and then relate it specifically to CSP. The IRP is premised on the fact that about 12,600 megawatts of ESCOM power plant has to be decommissioned. And my question there is, what if ESCOM does not decommission this 12,000 megawatts? Does this IRP then get pushed over to the 2040 period? And how are we stimulating this economy of ours in terms of bringing in investment and you know, reducing our unemployment number? So I just think from that point of view is we got to relook at this and say, maybe we got to have excess of power that is relatively cheap so we can stimulate the economy, do it the other way around. And in that way, if ESCOM does decommission any of its megawatts, then this new low-carbon economy, and CSP specifically, since it's able to create massive amounts of jobs during construction and operation, during construction, you know, direct jobs about 1,500 and indirect 4,000 jobs per plant, 80 permanent jobs during operation, can then absorb the jobs lost from that market. So it has to, we have to have a push in terms of how we grow this economy. Looking at the least cost of energy modeling, I come to ask the question, who is this least cost of energy benefiting right now? You know, personally, I'm paying R1.80 per kilowatt hour for electricity at my house. I'm not seeing the benefits right now, all right? So we have to find out, you know, the DOE has a difficult task in how they make sure that the customer benefits. But in doing the least cost of energy only excludes key criteria that we got to manage the grid from a stability point of view. We got to look at the learning curves for CSP to make sure that it's not omitted, because least cost of energy is the numbers that are in the public sector, okay? But there's a lot of learning curves both in South Africa and internationally that show CSP has decreased. Now, the DOE had to use some sort of assumptions to come up with the IRP, and you know, we're happy with that. But I think the Table 7 in the IRP is too prescriptive in that it talks about specific technologies, etc. Now, the DOE can't model all of these technologies. You know, there's hybrid technologies where you could use PV with batteries, or you could use CSP with PV, etc., that can show even lower cost of energy. So the table comes back to my previous point, is we've got to procure energy as and when we need it. Okay, so we do not exclude technologies. The IRP has to be technology neutral. Now, there is a statement in the IRP that says there are proxies, the PV, the wind, and the gas will be proxies for other technologies. But if that's not stated clearly, which technologies, etc., then they're going to be disinvestment in this country from big companies in terms of development costs. Learning rates were applied to certain technologies in the IRP, and specifically for CHP, you know, the international learning curves, etc., was not. So we're presenting today some of the learning curves to show that we can become very competitive in terms of including this technology. And, you know, EPRI was used as input data. It's fine. You know, we understand the DOE had to look at those numbers. But I think, you know, it would be good for us to see what numbers the CSP, what inputs were used in the modeling as well. So let's look at CSP, for instance. Apart from all of the other benefits in terms of it being able to generate power, baseload, mid-merit, and peaking, you know, just specifically on the IRP, we found that the CSP numbers were three times higher than what had been achieved already today. CSP in South Africa has been procured on a very constrained basis. So if you procure something on a constrained basis, then yes, the costs are not reflective of, the true costs are not reflective of the technology. I'll expand on that in the next few slides. But internationally, you know, CSP technologies like in Diwa, which 700 megawatts of CSP was procured, it was done at 7 US cents. You know, so the numbers are pretty low internationally. And on the back of that, we would hope that the DOE sees value in including CSP in the mix. This chart, this shows that in South Africa, under a constrained procurement window, we still managed to bring the tariffs down significantly. All right, there's a massive growth for CSP internationally, like I mentioned. There's 6,000 megawatts. There's over 6,000 megawatts in operation, and over 3,500 megawatts in construction. And there's, you know, going forward, there's massive growth in other parts of the world. China is doing a 1,000 megawatt pilot, and then they're going to go for a 5,000 megawatt CSP procurement very soon. Morocco, there's a gigawatt. Middle East, there's a gigawatt. You know, so CSP has the biggest growth learning curve of all technologies at this stage, and you know, we cannot exclude it from our mix. Now, South Africa has a very successful track record on concentrated solar power projects. To date, 600 megawatts has been procured by the Independent Power Producer Office, the IPP office. And, you know, all but two projects now are operational. They have been procured on different bases, all right? So some were procured to ensure there's power during the peaking, peak times, peak loads, and some were not. But there has been 6,000 megawatts of renewables in total procured, and only 10% has been CSP. So if only 10% has been CSP, then clearly there's not enough economies of scale to drive down the pricing in South Africa, even though the IPPs have ensured, almost 60% decrease in cost so far. So why is CSP being procured on a constrained basis? It's only capped to 100 megawatts in South Africa, okay? So over five rounds, only 600 megawatts of CSP has been procured. But in one round in Dubai, 700 megawatts in one round. So in five rounds in South Africa, we procured 600 megawatts. In one round in the DUR program, 700 megawatts. So of course, there's going to be massive decrease in pricing. There's zero compensation for generating power between 10 p.m. and 5 p.m. All right? There is a very important point here is that the power purchase agreement is only for 20 years. Now, we're doing these projects on the back of project financing. So we are trying to recover the cost of the project over 20 years. These projects have a design life of 30 years. Okay? And there's also very limited policy support in that only two projects were procured per CSP window, which means, there's not enough competition to drive the pricing down further. So, if you're procuring CSP on such constrained basis, then yes, the cost, the levelized cost of energy and the capital costs are going to be high. And on this basis, we cannot then say that CSP will be excluded from the generation mix. This is a slide, and the output is from an ESCOM presentation. And basically what ESCOM is saying is that wind and PV are efficient at producing energy, and we know that, and we've seen that based on their success stories in South Africa. But what CSP can offer is those two peak periods, which is in South Africa when the sun doesn't shine, CSP is able to generate power. We can also provide system support for ESCOM in that the CSP is predictable. Remember that energy is stored in tanks. So ESCOM can call that power as and when they need it. It's constant generation. It's very predictable. And, CSP is able to be a baseload, a peaker, or a wood merit. So there's a lot of advantages in bringing this technology, which is difficult to price in IRP modeling. Okay? And then specifically, the overnight capital cost that was used for CSP in the IRP, it specifically focused on one technology with 9 hours of storage. We looked at those numbers, and what we found is that the learning curves were not applied correctly. CSP is very cheap compared to what was put into the modeling. And, when you go to buy a car, you can't go buy a car and say, this car is expensive. Because chances are you went and you bought a Ferrari, right? But then you go and you buy a Mini, and it's going to be a different price. So CSP has different types of technologies behind it. You have Power Tower, which is the molten salt technology. You have trough technologies. You have linear Fresnel. So you have to apply learning curves across those various technologies. In our submission to the DOE, we're going to provide these input numbers to them as well. Now, CSP is very important is because the tariff is made up of a base tariff, which we sell energy to. But very important is that there is zero cost for fuel. So there's no exposure to foreign exchange. There's no exposure to a commodity like gas, which actually we don't have at this stage. Okay? So it's able to step into the shoes of the gas plants and baseload plants now because the technology is available. There's also, no cost for retrofitting in terms of trying to avoid greenhouse gas emissions. It is a renewable energy plant, and it has massive advantages for ESCOM system operations in terms of its dispatchability. We've ran some numbers in terms of CSP playing in the baseload and the mid-merit and the peaking, and you can see the overnight cost immediately is three times lower than what's being presented. So it's very important for the IRP to look at an holistic picture rather than just look at overnight costs and the least cost of energy. Technologies play a vital role in keeping our grid stable. This chart shows that based on those constrained procurement that I mentioned earlier is that, you know, we managed to bring down the tariff 65% already. And yes, we can do a lot more in terms of CSP and all of its benefits. Okay? So, you know, it's also very important, and I'll stress this again, is that concentrated solar power should be compared with technologies such as CCGT, nuclear, coal, etc. Because if we procure them large enough, and there's ample land in South Africa, in the Northern Cape, etc., that's not being used at the moment, and if we procure it on a large-scale basis, there's a technology today that's proven in South Africa that can take on that role. You know, those plants have long economic lifespans, 30 years and bigger. And, you know, the solar resource in South Africa is amongst the best in the world for CSP. I think we're second only to Chile. So we have this fantastic free resource that we're not taking advantage of. This is a chart that we came up to kind of guide the DOE and say, listen, if we procure the technology on an uncapped basis and an unconstrained PPA, there's a lot more we can do in terms of driving down the tariffs and increasing the benefits to South Africa. I think the other point also is that when you look at these tariffs, the way the DOE procures right now is massive support for social and economic development, enterprise development, and localization. So these tariffs have a lot more benefits to South Africa than just being an energy tariff. And even at those levels, you know, that's a very good story for South Africa. So coming to an end, and I want to summarize, the IRP, the Integrated Resource Plan, is our master plan. It's a plan that we need to look at today, tomorrow, and for the future generation as well. You know, the IRP must not limit investment in South Africa. Development of projects in terms of environmental authorization, securing of land, etc., there's a 2 or 3 year lead time for that. That costs 8 to 10 million rand that developers put at risk per project. Okay? They take a 2 year look and say, hey, what would the DOE procure at that time? Then they start environmental impact assessments, they go and secure water, secure land, grid connection, etc. So if the IRP now becomes too specific in technologies and people do not invest in development, then it's going to be very difficult to procure energy when we need it because the turnaround time is going to be much longer, and which will be detrimental to our economic growth. Equity investment is very important because if technologies are excluded from the IRP, then you know, you're going to have large companies leaving the country and investing in other markets. You know, I showed slides where there's a lot more happening in Chile and in Australia and China, etc., and that's where people will take their foreign direct investments, and we need foreign direct investment in this country. And then, you know, the IRP must not limit technology. You know, don't limit technology. Technology, you know, as we stand today, if you look at yesterday, Eskom put out a notice yesterday to say there'll be load shedding. And then late at night, Eskom said load shedding was avoided. And of the three options that was used to avoid that, two was renewable energy. CSP provided energy during the peak, and wind. Okay? So technology cannot be limited in the IRP because it's innovation that actually saved us from load shedding last night. And I'm happy to say CSP played a critical role in that. The DOE also has to look at the IRP and then look at the procurement of technology on an agnostic basis. Don't be specific. Don't say wind. Don't say PV, etc. You know, we've got to say for baseload, mid-merit, and peaking, this is what we need, and this is a competitive bid. I mean, there's a lot of improvement in battery storage. And PV, you know, the PV sector will be able to bid PV with battery storage on a competitive basis, you know. So we would like the DOE to look at that. So CSP can play in those markets. And I think the last point I'm going to make is that the IRP has to be updated every 2 years. And this is just because technology is advancing at such a rate that I think we're missing out on key development opportunities for this country. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll check the next presentation. So, on honorable members will ask questions later on. From my side, there may be a number of suggestions being made in each of the presentations. But I want to hear at the end of the day, before the motivation, what are you saying? What are you saying must change in the current diaspora? So each one of the presentations, at the end, I want to hear. So what's the proposal so that we can go look and see what's facing. So, because the proposal sometimes can be clouded in the motivations, which are important, but we need a summary of what if we were to just make three proposals of everything, which ones are the most important for you to go to be considered in the possible division of the RP. So just want to make that point for each of the presentations. That's quite important for us sitting this side. Okay, so next presentation. So Mr. Cotter, saying 25 minutes. We can start. I don't know who's making the presentation. This Ms. N. Mr. Kota says this is Losa. Is that correct?
Thanks, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Chairperson and members, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Robin Hugo, and my colleague is Nicole Losa. We are attorneys at the Centre for Environmental Rights. At the CER, we are activist lawyers who help communities and civil society organizations realize our constitutional rights to a healthy environment. And we do that by advocating and litigating for environmental justice. I think, Chair, our one takeaway point will become quite clear soon. The CER and environmental justice organizations Groundwork and Earth Life Africa form the Life After Coal campaign, which aims to discourage the development of new coal-fired power stations and mines, reduce emissions from our existing coal infrastructure, and encourage a coal phase-out so we can enable a just transition to sustainable energy systems for the people. While our written submissions to the Portfolio Committee cover several concerns with the IRP, we're going to focus today on the 1,000 megawatts of new coal capacity that has been forced into the IRP as a policy adjustment in circumstances where the IRP itself recognizes that this coal is unnecessary and not least cost. As a crucial planning document with significant implications for the health, well-being, and livelihoods of all of us, the IRP must respect, protect, promote, and fulfill constitutional rights. Section 24 of our Constitution guarantees us the right to an environment not harmful to health or well-being, and the right to have that environment protected for the benefit of present and future generations. The state, then, has a duty to take reasonable legislative and other measures to give effect to that right. Now, the Electricity Regulation Act defines the IRP as a resource plan established by the national sphere of government to give effect to national policy. That means that if the IRP doesn't do so, it is unlawful. Relevant national policy will then include the White Paper on Energy Policy, and that recognizes that energy prices must be as cost-reflective as possible and must include externalities. Another example is our National Development Plan that calls for an energy sector that by 2030 provides reliable and efficient energy service at competitive rates, social equity through expanded access to affordable energy, as well as environmental sustainability through efforts to reduce pollution and mitigate climate change. Our submission is that the IRP, although we must admit is a substantial improvement on the 2016 draft and the IRP 2010, doesn't align with the law, and in particular, the Constitution. We say this for the reasons that are reflected on these four slides, although, as I've said, we're going to focus today on the first point, which is the inclusion of unnecessary and harmful new coal capacity in the IRP. An IRP that calls for unnecessary, expensive new coal-fired power at a time when we need to be urgently transitioning away from harmful coal is simply not a reasonable measure to protect our right to a healthy environment, as the Constitution requires. It appears that the 1,000 megawatts of new coal reflected in the IRP relates to two independent coal power stations that were announced preferred bidders under the Department of Energy's Coal Baseload IPP procurement program in October 2016. So that's Thabametsi, which is proposed to be based in Lephalale, Limpopo, and Khanyisa, which is proposed in Emalahleni in Mpumalanga. The Life After Coal campaign has been opposing both projects, challenging their environmental authorizations in court and opposing their operating licenses. Last year, Earthlife Africa succeeded in landmark High Court litigation against the Minister of Environmental Affairs, which confirmed that the climate change impacts of the Thabametsi station should have been considered as part of the environmental impact assessment before a decision was made to authorize Thabametsi. So really, we're challenging these power stations because we believe that the decisions to authorize them are unreasonable, irrational, unlawful, and in conflict with the Constitution. So why is it unreasonable and unconstitutional to include new coal in the IRP? Burning coal for electricity has devastating impacts on human health, the climate, and the environment, including water resources. We know that air pollution from only one pollutant from Eskom coal-fired power stations is responsible for at least 2,200 deaths every year and thousands of cases of bronchitis and asthma in adults and children annually, costing South Africa more than 34 billion rand a year. We also know that coal-fired power stations are notorious heavy users and polluters of our limited water resources, and that they have irreversible climate impacts through their high GHG emissions. Thabametsi and Khanyisa will pose unacceptable risks to South Africa's precious water resources, and both projects will be based in air quality priority areas where our outdated national ambient air quality standards under the Air Quality Act are already being exceeded. Allowing further emissions in these areas, even if the projects meet our weak minimum emission standards, will bring the air quality further out of compliance with our air quality standards. This would cause additional unlawful risks to health and well-being and violate the constitutional environmental rights. Both projects also pose unacceptable climate change risks. These two plants are particularly GHG emission intensive, 60% more so than Eskom's Medupi and Kusile. That makes them two of the most emission-intensive plants in the world. And a report by the Energy Research Center shows that they would effectively negate the government's GHG emission mitigation plans and efforts. So they would frustrate South Africa's commitments under the Paris Agreement through requiring significant GHG emission reductions in the power and other sectors where reductions are more difficult and more expensive. The ERC finds that if South Africa takes its climate change commitment seriously, it would cost the country 28 billion extra rand to stay within the low peak plateau decline trajectory if the coal IPPs are built. The IRP gives no consideration to these high external costs of coal, and such limited externality figures as are provided only for emissions are significantly understated. As a water-scarce country, it's imperative that electricity planning gives proper and full consideration to the sector's impacts on South Africa's water resources. Yet the draft IRP completely fails to account for the significant water costs and water usage of the various electricity source options, although the draft IRP itself recognizes that it should minimize negative emissions and water usage. Of course, our country is also particularly vulnerable to the impacts of climate change, but the IRP fails to consider the climate change costs of coal. then quite apart from the significant cost to the state that arises from the health impacts of pollution and the water and climate costs, the two coal IPP projects would also cause significant economic and financial harm to Eskom, to Treasury, to municipalities, and to electricity consumers by increasing electricity prices. Now, Chair, we say there is simply no benefit that outweighs or justifies these harmful impacts. All credible modeling shows that coal is now far outpaced in terms of cost and efficiency by other electricity sources like renewable solar PV and wind, together with flexible generation, such as gas or, ideally, storage. As the IRP confirms, South Africa does not need additional electricity capacity, and if new capacity is needed in future, coal is certainly not the least cost or most efficient source for that electricity. Far from being good for our economy, Thabametsi and Khanyisa alone will end up costing South Africa an additional 20 billion rand. This is confirmed by ERC's research and by the Minister of Energy, who in fact advised the additional cost would be 23 billion. The ERC report confirms that not only are the coal IPPs not required to meet demand, and not only do they raise costs and increase emissions, but they also result in increasing pressure on Eskom. Building new coal plants in a situation of low demand means reducing the output of Eskom's fleet, potentially accelerating the utility death spiral in which Eskom already finds itself, and putting the electricity supply industry, and thus the South African economy, at risk. Eskom is facing a financial crisis, and rising electricity prices will drive consumers away from the utility. By developing new and unnecessary coal infrastructure, the risk of stranded assets is also further increased, meaning that some coal plants will have to close much earlier than anticipated. Climate change will also likely impact the plant's ability to operate. The Minister himself has confirmed that the coal IPPs will raise electricity prices for consumers, and the draft IRP confirms that a least cost plan does not include new coal capacity. We have to then ask why the coal IPPs are being forced into the IRP, given that they do not form part of a least cost plan, as the IRP itself confirms, and given these irreversible impacts they will have for our health, climate, and environment. The draft IRP provides two reasons for forcing them in, the first being that they are already procured and announced, and the second is that they will provide jobs. Nicole's going to talk to us about both.
Thank you. Sorry, I see there's something wrong with some of our slides. Apologies. So to state that these projects are already procured is simply not correct. The draft IRP itself confirms that these projects are not committed, and the request for proposals governing the coal IPP program confirms that the Department of Energy can withdraw from these projects at any time without the coal IPPs having any claims against the department. In truth, the coal IPPs are a long way from commercial and financial close, with multiple unresolved disputes, including High Court review cases pending, and with licenses outstanding and being challenged. Major civil society opposition will see all their required licenses and authorizations being challenged on appeal and in court, and this will give rise to significant delays. We understand that Eskom, the DOE, and Treasury still have to provide various approvals before any power purchase agreements could be signed. Among these approvals is a confirmation from the DOE or Eskom that the projects are value for money. This is required by the new generation regulations under the Electricity Regulation Act. This is how value for money is defined in the new generation regulations and in the request for proposals for the coal IPP program. As you can see, the projects must provide a net benefit to Eskom and government, and they must be in their best interests and in the best interests of the people of South Africa. The fact that the draft IRP itself confirms that these projects do not form part of a least cost plan, and the fact that the Minister of Energy has advised that they will cost South Africa an extra 23 billion rand, demonstrates that they are clearly not value for money. We have warned the DOE and Eskom that these projects are not in the public interest, and that they are well within their legal power and discretion to withdraw from them. To assume that the coal IPPs are a foregone conclusion and to include them in the IRP on that basis is, with respect, incorrect, irrational, and unlawful. In relation to the second reason for forcing the coal IPPs into the plan, this being that the jobs created from the projects will minimize the impact of job losses, we submit that building two expensive, harmful, and unnecessary new coal plants simply for the sake of providing jobs is a reckless solution to South Africa's unemployment problems. We do not dispute that unemployment is a serious issue that needs to be urgently addressed, or that there should indeed be concern around ensuring continued livelihoods for workers in the coal sector. The solution, however, does not lie in the coal IPPs, particularly because these projects, through raising electricity costs and placing additional strain on Eskom, consumers, and municipalities, will have severe negative impacts for the economy, in particular for businesses and jobs. A global report coordinated by the Institute for Sustainable Development and International Relations and Climate Strategies, to which South Africa's ERC was also a contributor, addresses the implementation of coal transitions globally. This report makes it clear that a coal transition is inevitable and has been underway in South Africa and globally for some time already. In other words, it is not a question of if South Africa phases out of coal, but when. There will be further job losses in the coal sector unless government puts in place credible, well-communicated, and expertly executed plans to support workers and diversify the economy towards other labor-intensive sectors. The Coal Transitions Report highlights the benefits of taking steps now rather than later in order for a transition to be just and inclusive. It also finds that coal transitions are affordable for energy consumers because the transition away from coal is the least cost option for South Africa. In short, what this report makes clear is that building new coal plants, locking South Africa into expensive, unnecessary, and outdated infrastructure is the worst thing that South Africa could do, including for coal workers and the unemployed. Rather than subsidize the coal industry, support should go to the workers directly, including in efforts to retrain and reskill coal workers. Existing and potential jobs in the renewable energy sector, which could also be located in mining areas such as the Mpumalanga Highveld, should be recognized and supported. In fact, the DOE's own study finds that 30% more permanent direct jobs per unit of energy are created with a renewable energy mix than with coal. The research shows that solar PV and wind are more job-intensive along the entire value chain than coal-fired power stations. These are also likely to be more resilient than coal jobs, which will become increasingly vulnerable in a world on the decarbonization path. What's more, the legally required decommissioning of Eskom's coal plants and rehabilitation of coal mines and land impacted by coal mining would result in extensive employment opportunities, particularly for ex-mine and power station workers. So, neither of the two grounds advanced by the DOE justifies the coal IPPs being forced into the IRP. Building the coal IPPs also delays the urgent need to decarbonize the electricity sector to mitigate the severe threat of climate change. The draft IRP fails to emphasize or even acknowledge this threat or the urgency to phase out South Africa's dependence on fossil fuels in the electricity sector. As this slide, which is an excerpt from South Africa's own climate change policy, shows, even conservative emission scenarios are predicted to have devastating impacts for South Africa, with life as we know it predicted to change completely. Alarmingly, a significant portion of South Africa's electricity will still be derived from fossil fuels by 2030. The draft IRP's forecasted decline in coal capacity is more than offset by the 6,732 megawatts of new coal to come from the coal IPPs and the remaining units of Medupi and Kusile, and the 8,100 megawatts of new gas or diesel capacity. This is not consistent with, nor does it give effect to national policy, which, as mentioned earlier, the IRP is legally required to do, nor is it aligned with the Constitution. It is also counter to the global move away from fossil fuels. It is not enough for the draft IP to fall within the peak plateau decline trajectory and the current Paris Agreement commitments. Firstly, because our Paris commitments are regarded by many and rated by Climate Action Tracker as highly insufficient. And secondly, because these commitments will have to become stricter every 5 years, meaning that compliance now will not necessarily be compliance in 10 years' time. To put it simply, South Africa is legally required to do much more, much sooner, to drastically reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. A landmark report released last week by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change on global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius confirms that human activities have already caused approximately 1 degree of global warming above pre-industrial levels, resulting in increased natural disasters, droughts, and rising sea levels. It also confirms that the risks of allowing temperature increases to reach even 1.5 degrees Celsius are dire. The Paris Agreement currently sets the target at 2 degrees. It finds that limiting warming to 1.5 degrees would require rapid and far-reaching transitions in land, energy, industry, buildings, transport, and cities. Global net human-caused emissions of carbon dioxide must fall by about 45% from 2010 levels by the year 2030, and we need to reach net zero around the year 2050. This report means, firstly, that on our current trajectory, all people in South Africa and our future generations are exposed to irreversible, devastating impacts, and secondly, that drastic interventions are required now to avoid this. Our Constitution demands that more urgent, bolder steps be taken. A Dutch appeal court, in the case of the State of the Netherlands versus the Urgenda Foundation, last week confirmed that the state was acting unlawfully and in contravention of the duty of care by failing to pursue a more ambitious greenhouse gas emission reduction plan. These quotes from the judgment demonstrate some of the damning findings against the Dutch government. So this case confirms that adopting effective and adequate climate change mitigation measures is in fact a legal and constitutional obligation on the state. Simply adhering to inadequate targets does not in any way discharge the state's constitutional duties to implement proper greenhouse gas emission reduction measures. In summary, the research shows that an urgent and inclusive just transition away from coal is in the public interest, and it is the least cost option. We need to abandon any unnecessary new coal-fired power and expedite the decommissioning of our aging coal fleet. Fortunately, we can decarbonize the electricity sector, which is responsible for a significant portion of our emissions, relatively easily and affordably, more so than other sectors like transport and agriculture. And doing so comes with the added co-benefits for human health, water, and improving access to clean and affordable electricity. South Africa no longer needs to choose between clean and cheap electricity. Renewables have been cheaper than coal for some time now, even without factoring the high external costs of coal. For these reasons, we submit that a final IRP that includes new coal-fired power plants is unconstitutional, and it will be met with legal challenge. Thank you.
Was that clear, Chair, what we wanted?
Thanks very much. Next presentation. I think that's clear to the DG.
Honourable Chair, honourable members, members of the public, thank you very much for this opportunity. Just as a bit of a background, my name's Bruce Main. I'm a group executive of the Ivy Group of Companies from Johannesburg. And I've been in the investment industry for over 20 years, and a lot of that focus is on listening to CEOs, CFOs, business development, where things are going. And obviously, what I'm trying to give in this presentation is an energy roadmap of South Africa, some of the implications of new technology, where things are going, and how we can do things differently, which I think will be better for all South Africans. I think from a legal perspective, we've heard some of the concerns on coal. We also heard earlier the concentrated solar, which has storage capacity in it. And this talk is really about energy storage, where it's going and where it's going into the future, and how it actually impacts considerable parts of our economy, which in some ways we'd think that are unrelated. But I'll give you some detail in exactly where I think South Africa can position itself in the storage market and what we can do differently. So what I'd like to see in the RFP is, especially in the new economic zone that's proposed by our president, I'd like to see partnerships with battery technology specialist businesses so we can build battery storage and battery storage capacity in South Africa right across the board for energy, as well as looking at potentially our car market, improving our ability to have electric vehicles. And I think if South Africa becomes less reliant on oil and fuels, it'll make our economy more competitive. And we all know at the moment, as South Africans, how expensive the oil price is and what impact it has. Open cycle gas turbines, which we managed to avoid using yesterday, would have been horrendously expensive. And we've heard again from Mr. Govender from Solar Reserve how we were able to use renewables, and renewables combined with storage will make a significant difference. So first, I think what I'd like to say is every major economy that I've looked at, and that's from the UK, Europe, Australia, America, Canada, and China, all of them have dedicated departments that are focused on battery storage and where the technology is going. So it's one of the areas, I think, combined with the CSIR, with the IDC, we've built incredible businesses in South Africa, Sasol, Exxaro, Eskor, to name but a few. Why can we not set a program in place where we can start executing on battery storage and having a potential export market in the utility and the car market? And again, I'll elaborate further. What I'm very concerned about is our car market and the potential of devastation that could happen if electric vehicles do become this most sought-after vehicle, and we're starting to see it in America. We know the Chinese policy, they've got real problems with pollution in China. They're opting for electric vehicles because pollution is a problem. When your two biggest economies in the world are adopting electric vehicles, I think we need to wake up and realize that this is where the industry is going. Let's play part of that future, and we are able to, A, facilitate changes in our utility side, as well as obviously prevent job losses and, in fact, increase job opportunities in the car market. So if we just look at the simple technologies and where it's going to go, the storage market, which is indicated by Citigroup, is $400 billion by 430 billion dollars by 2030. Now, I know a big number like this, it's just a big number. So let's try and contextualize it. If we looked at our potential nuclear energy program that we were going to build, that was a 10-odd-year program, which was going to cost R1 trillion, and that was 10 years. That is 7 of those nuclear build programs every year by 2030 in the energy storage business. If we as South Africans can participate in that, we can massively increase our export capacity and the ability to grow the economy from an export point of view, as well as obviously utility usage for ourselves. What are the technologies that are available? Well, as we know, lithium-ion, that's in your cell phone. Vanadium redox flow batteries, this is the one that I'm particularly excited about. Eskom's got a joint venture with Bushveld Minerals. This is an opportunity for us to change the platinum belt, and again, I'll go through some more details on exactly why I think it's important to give this technology a chance. But if we can build a center that I'm pretty much technology agnostic. I mean, these things change over time. But if we can build a center that focuses on giving us the ability to produce these batteries and battery storage, it's able to move into the car industry, into the renewable programs, et cetera. So I really think that this is so important and essential to look at. My proposal would be, in the economic zone proposed, that we would look at producing an R&D and mega facility. The reason why we would want to do that is over time, those mega facilities are basically able to reduce the cost of production and have electricity produced in battery storage facilities at very effective costs. So again, with partners, some of the ones that that come to mind are BYD from China. There's Ronki Power, which is a specialist in vanadium redox flow batteries. These are the type of partners that we can bring on board and help us produce batteries and have the ability to export them out of South Africa as well as obviously be used in our renewable programs. From a mineral perspective, and this is where I think, again, job opportunities and the ability to expand South Africa's mines as opposed to seeing them contract, all of the materials that we need for these batteries, and you can see... If you look at the African continent, they're all there. They're all here. So from our point of view, partnering with the right businesses and being able to beneficate these minerals into an export market as well as local is so essential to job creation for South Africans and obviously changing our whole energy outlook. So now I'll get on to what I'm worried about from a labor perspective. Our car industry is $165 billion a year export market, and that's 14% of SA's total exports. If we don't have a facility that has the R&D capacity and can produce batteries for the original equipment car-making market, we have a potential risk that over time we don't produce motor vehicles in South Africa and we start losing the capacity to produce it because we don't have the skills on battery and battery storage technology. So I think that is really, really important, and that brings us back into the platinum arena. If we notice that America and China are no longer or certainly starting to look at procuring electric vehicles and that's becoming a preference, that has an impact in the platinum market. A third of platinum supply goes into diesel catalytic converters and into normal catalytic converters, so that is a threat to the platinum belt and obviously job losses, which we have seen. So again, you know, it's funny how, and I think energy, if we look at it separately and rather weave it into the various facets of the South African economy, you can see why it's so important that storage and battery storage and how it can make a difference. So we know with the higher energy prices, we've also had factory closures. So what can we do that's going to be able to do things slightly differently? So if we look at the platinum belt, now that's the Bushveld complex in South Africa. It is also the richest vanadium belt in the world. So we've got the capacity of the raw supplies to the battery technology can go into vanadium redox flow batteries, which is basically the ability to have utility scale storage. So what examples, and I think this is very important, because is it a new technology? Is it working? Where is it working? That's also extremely important. And again, on this side, there's a 200-megawatt facility that's been built in China, and that's on vanadium redox technology. So it is there, it is working, and I think possibly the best example is towards the end of the presentation, which was Elon Musk's 100-megawatt Hornsdale battery system that they put in Australia. And I think the reason why that's quite important is because it gives us a good indication of the same constraints that South Africa has on the grid. Australia, believe it or not, also has similar problems. And I'll give you some detailed ideas of why that has made a significant difference for Australia. So if we look at growing and nurturing local talent, Fortune Mojafela, who is the CEO of Bushveld Minerals, that's our own South African homegrown company. It's got a current joint venture with Eskom in vanadium redox storage facilities. And again, it's all of this technology and availability, it's here in the country. Let's nurture it, let's grow it, and let's export it. That is for me, a huge plus for the RP program going forward. So we now get on to does it work? And if we think of last night, we almost went into a situation where we had to run the open cycle gas turbines. And this is a classic example. In Australia, very similar to us, they've had quite a lot of constraint on the grid. The 100 megawatt battery facility that they built onto a wind farm in Australia is now used as for their FCAS price when they've got instability on the grid. Your batteries come in. They don't have to be synced to the grid. So unlike most other emergency situations, you have to fire up the gas turbines, get them synced to the grid, and then you have power. Batteries, it's instantaneous. So they actually are the preferred method now in emergency situations where you do have trips at power stations. So what we're starting to see is the ability to smooth solar and wind output. So again, it's an area that I think is essential for our government to look at. The other side on the vanadium redox flow batteries is the lifespan, as opposed to lithium ion battery. They can be basically stored up full of energy and left for months on months, and they don't diffuse the energy out of it like lithium ion. So from a utility perspective, these are actually far better technology batteries than lithium ion, and we've got, as I said, the biggest vanadium belt in the world that's right here. So if I look at the whole outlook and the investment destination South Africa and try and link energy, labor, growth in South Africa, the car market, etc., what are we able to do if we start with a really well-thought-out energy storage program with batteries? We're able to retain jobs. We're able to create more jobs. There's mining growth within the platinum industry, which has been in terrible trouble. We're able to potentially move people into areas in the vanadium belt where you can start keeping people in place and actually add jobs. There's a beneficiation program, which I think can benefit South Africa from a jobs perspective. Then purely from the energy side, we can actually produce the utilities and the batteries here in South Africa. We've got a car market that we're able to expand on. And in fact, if you've got the battery ability to produce car batteries, you're able to supply into that market and retain the car industry and, in fact, grow it. One of my concerns, and I'm not going to mention the name, but we're talking about a major German car company that saw the biggest decline of car sales in America ever in the last 3.5 months. So this is a real, it is real now. It's cars and the change of transport modes is changing, and I think we need to be aware of that. So finally, I think that aligns South Africa, and we keep on talking about the fourth industrial revolution. These are the type of things that we can do and do differently. Yeah, so finally, I think it also gives us the capacity, if we're able to have adequate storage, renewable energy programs, they become, and as I said, it was mentioned earlier by Mr. Govender, when you've got a situation where you've got reserve power and the ability to store it, you suddenly turn wind and solar energy into 24-hour power stations. You've got some degree of baseload power. So I think it puts South Africa into a more competitive energy environment and takes us into the future. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
supposed to have questions if honourable members do have, but I suggest we pause for 5 minutes before we take questions.
I wish you were there. Yar di tera lo te lo khale aje
I want to go to the house. Because I don't know if you have any mind,
Thank you. Thank you. Morning, everybody. I'm representing the Land Rights Organization of South Africa from Springs, who was situated in Johannesburg. This IRP update comes at the backdrop of the Paris Climate Agreement, to which South Africa is a signatory, which comes as a result of realization that our drive for economic sustenance actually has a negative impact for future generations and ourselves, as the impact on environmental degradation and quality of life degenerates for the poor, while a few benefit economically and, most importantly, kills the environment, which is key for such economic sustenance. As the Land Rights Organization of South Africa, we are here to point out fundamental failures of this IRP, which continues the drive for economic sustenance for the few, while it promotes environmental degradation and quality of life for the poor. We are boldly encouraged by Section 24 of the South African Constitution, which protects our right to an environment that is not harmful to our health or well-being, and to have the environment protected for the benefit of the present and future generations. While the draft IRP focuses mostly on the economic drivers and is shown by the kind of organizations that were consulted in the build-up to the compilation of this document, which are banks and business organizations, people who are concerned about the economic benefits more than the environment and the well-being of our people and future generations. Our focus will be on exposing the dangers that this IRP update exposes to today's and future generations. The impact on the economy. The consequences of the draft of 2015-2016 in South Africa, as contained in Oxfam SA's 2016 report, titled A Harvest of Dysfunction, are scary, and the draft IRP does not show any signs of commitment to address the problems of GHG emissions in order to ensure that the same is not repeated. The statistics are as follows. With a focus on food price rises, low-income households' food inflation was at 19.1% in 2016. The impact on food prices because of drought are an indication of food insecurity in the country. And with this plan, we should expect worse than it was in 2016, as we take into account factors such as increase in VAT, etc. So this is our concern. Farm indebtedness. Increase in commercial farm bankruptcies had led to 45% increase in farm sales over 15 months, as the current debt-to-assets ratio of 33% escalates as a result of production failure. This was the situation in 2016, perpetrated by draft only. More of this scenario can be expected with a proposal on land expropriation without compensation, which is not clear. Therefore, we are saying that at least let us have the economic problem of landlessness of the majority to deal with in the near future, and not have it coupled with this impact of draft in our planning. Impact on food security continued. Agricultural restructuring. Smallholder and subsistence farmers are the hardest hit, which may lead to favoring bigger farms and cluster groups in the production and supply of food. These are statistics only to people who are not affected by the same situation, but to the poor people whom we represent here today, these are not statistics, but real people that we know and can put faces to.
Our presence here today signifies the so-called statistics speaking. Looking at me and call me no statistic, but remember that I was here, the one who is directly affected by the effects of whatever we are planning was here speaking, and it is no statistic. I am raising this as we activists around the world are engaged in a Land Rights Now campaign to coincide with the World Food Day, which was marked yesterday, October 15. This campaign continues until 26 October and calls on all of us to remember that it is because of the environment we live in. Every time we pick a spoon and eat something. Many of my comrades around the world are marking this day by having food festivities. So I'm inviting all of you as we go for lunch to join the campaign and demand land rights now so that we can have many more of these lunches. And most importantly, remember not to reduce chances of having these lunches as we deliberate on the RP 2018. Some 100,000 farm workers lost their jobs in 2017 only, according to the Agricultural Business Chamber, ARPIS. A look at the draft IRP and the reason for the replacement of the decommissioning power stations focuses on saving the jobs of those who are employed at these power stations. But if we do not plan carefully, this dreadful figure shows us that by degrading the environment, we are in fact losing more jobs than the ones that we purport to be saving. Impact on water resources. 7.3 million households and 33.3 million people had experienced insecure access to drinking water at the start of the 2015 summer rainy season. So these are some of the problems that are experienced by the people when self-induced natural disasters occur. So this is what we want the planners to actually think about. When added together, the nationally determined contributions of all countries are currently not sufficient to meet the 2% target. All countries, including South Africa, need to set more ambitious targets in the very near future. As one of the largest and highly energy-intensive economies on the African continent, South Africa needs to lead the way and increase its efforts. South Africa's peak plateau and decline trajectory suggests that a significant reduction in emissions of greenhouse gas emissions will not be attempted until 2025. One key assumption is that economic growth will not be possible without emissions growth decoupling before then. This assumption we challenge, as this is shown by the impact on the economy in the previous slide, and it is this assumption that hampers the much-needed transition to a low-carbon economy. A lot of investments and infrastructure programs currently underway or planned are contradicting South Africa's mitigation commitments, such as the new coal fired power plants such as Thabametsi and Khanyisa, or Operation Phakisa. To sum this up, we like to mention that there can be no reduction in greenhouse gas emissions without the reduction in capacity to generate power from coal. One would hope that South Africa would show more commitment to shifting from these types of investments and invest more in renewable energy sources, such as PV and wind. But no, this IRP suggests that we are in fact planning to increase the capacity even further and better our position as the 17th polluter of the environment in the world. In conclusion, we would like to mention that the draft IRP 2018 as it is does not have a comparison table that carries the projected electricity demand, any previously generated and stored electricity both from coal-fired plants and renewable energy sources, and thus deprives us the ability to determine what the actual reductions be. No mere covering up the actual demand in electricity by renewable energy sources while maintaining the level of our national determined contributions from fossils. Moreover, the planned reductions in emissions must be coupled by what they really owe to. And what they owe to cannot be anything except the reduction in capacity to generate electricity from coal, which means that we are planning no reduction at all if we are planning to increase the capacity, as this IRP 2018 seeks to do. Lastly, we feel that the coming decommissioning of the coal-fired power stations should in fact be celebrated by a country that is committed to its mitigation mandate that then replaced as this document seeks to do. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Next presentation, Kose. Evergreen, is there somebody from Western Wind Energy?
Yes, Chairman.
We're waiting for you. Take your seat here.
Chairman, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Paul McNaughton. I represent two development companies, Western Wind Energy and Evergreen Renewable Energy. We're relatively small developers, but we've been in this business for some time. A bit of background. In 1996, Eskom warned that the country was running out of electricity. We then had generation capacity of 40,000 megawatts with about a 15% reserve, but with many aging coal-fired stations. It asked for approval for a new build program. The request was turned down. In 2007, President Thabo Mbeki apologized for the country's power problems and he admitted that the government should have listened to Eskom and built excess capacity. Today, Eskom capacity has shrunk to around 30,000 megawatts, and the only reason we have not run out of power is because many big users, such as the aluminium smelters, have been turned off and demand has shrunk in line with the economy. Economists estimate that the economy would have been 10% bigger by the end of 2014 if it had not been for crippling power shortages. That translates to more than 300 billion or more than 1 million job opportunities lost. And my source for this is a book entitled Blackout, the Eskom Crisis by James Brent Stein. Please let us not make this mistake again. No power equals no investment. The advantages of renewable energy. Okay, so let's give the government some credit. There is light at the end of the tunnel. The government introduced a policy called the Renewable Energy Independent Power Producers Program, which has been acknowledged as being one of the best programs of its type in the world when it was allowed to operate. And as this rolled out, South Africa became the recipient of environmentally friendly clean energy with the following benefits: no smoke, little water used, no ash pollution, lower operating costs, and shorter lead times to build. For example, to bring a renewable energy project into production could be done in 2 years versus the 10 years plus it requires for a Kusuli or Medupi. More benefits. All REI PPP projects are funded by private capital and require no financial input from government except a power producing agreement underwritten by the Treasury. This is very good for pension fund type investments, providing a non-volatile stream of income for 20 years. All bids have the result of improving the land. So in terms of the documentation that I have seen, it requires removing alien vegetation, such as Port Jackson and Rooikrans here in the Western Cape, and allowing dual use of the area for agriculture. Farming can take place between turbines, and even solar, where sheep are allowed to graze between the panels. Due to the runoff from the panels and increased water retention, which has improved grazing and carrying capacity. And I've seen this with my own eyes at the first large solar installation at Kokbok up in the Northern Cape, which was connected in 2011. The farmer told me that the surrounding Karoo land had a carrying capacity of one sheep to about 3 hectares, but in the area where the solar panels were, his carrying capacity increased to 1 to 1, which is quite significant. The economic benefits. Prices have continually come down. At the start of the program, they were 1 rand 14 per kilowatt hour. But in window one, to 62 cents per kilowatt hour in bid window 4A. There is job creation in construction and in the operational phase. The BEE component in the bidding rules results in 1.6% of gross revenue being allocated to enterprise development and socio-economic projects. The specific case that I want to make for Western Wind and Evergreen is that we have formed a partnership with Estonian know-how and capital. So that's obviously a European country, and this has resulted in money flowing to South Africa for the development of these projects. However, during the 3-year renewable energy stalemate, when nuclear became the flavor of the month and no new power purchase agreements were signed by Eskom, we were forced to withdraw some of this money in order to follow potential projects overseas. This is a lost opportunity because this money should have remained in South Africa in order to develop the very projects that will help kickstart the South African economy. We have to give you an example. We have on our books a project situated on land belonging to a previously dispossessed community 60 kilometers from Cape Town, CBD. There is direct access to a substation which has the capacity, and the line from the substation to Kuiberg nuclear power station has recently been upgraded, allowing almost immediate transfer of power to the city of Cape Town once the project has been bid, approved and constructed. A project like this is a win-win for everyone. The national government will win because it can be seen to be transferring land back to previously dispossessed communities with enormous employment, enterprise and socio-economic upliftment benefits. The local community will win. In this particular case, it is estimated that the benefits could amount to 8 million rand in the first year and 350 million over the 20-year life of the project. Not to mention the 130 jobs that will be created and the 5% equity or shareholding that the community will be entitled to, which will be underwritten by the IDC. The city of Cape Town will win by having access to cheaper, cleaner energy compared to Kusuli and Medupi, which are coal-fired and I believe will generate at about 1 rand 50 per kilowatt-hour as opposed, and I'm sorry, there's a typo there, as opposed to 60 cents, not 60 rand, 60 cents per kilowatt-hour in the last bidding round. So less than half. The developers will win, recouping money already spent, generating some profit, which will encourage them to do further developments. And that is the nature of capitalism. We believe that this project and others like it, where dispossessed communities are actually the lessor, in other words, they own the land, should receive priority treatment over and above the 30-70 point scoring system already in place. The bid committee allocates 30% of the points that are allocated to a company's bid to your BEE credentials and 70% to price, just to clarify that point. It will also eliminate transmission losses. This project has become more feasible and urgent because the cost of transmitting power from the coal-fired stations in Mpumalanga all the way down to the Cape. There are significant energy losses of between 15 and 20% which occur in the process, probably getting worse every day due to the aging nature of Eskom's infrastructure. Conclusion. We are delighted that the Independent Power Producers Program has been reinstated. Our Estonian partners are ready to reinvest. The IRP, for which I'm making this presentation, page 41, as well intentioned as it may be, indicates that the next round of new capacity will only be commissioned in 2025. This means that bidding will open in 2023 or thereabouts. We have already been waiting for 8 years for this project, and we cannot wait another 5 with no income. The money will go back offshore. We would urge you, therefore, to recommend a bidding date in 2019, which closes by the end of 2019, with financial close in 2020. If there is projected income to be derived in the next 3 years, it will help keep our company and others like it alive and help grow the economy. This is totally in line with the President's initiative to provide stimulus to the South African economy, and it is our sincere hope that you adapt the RP accordingly. Without excess generation capacity, we will not attract investment. This would be a vote of confidence in the future of South Africa. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Screen is ready. South Africans.
Honorable Chairperson and members, yes, we are listening.
Yeah, very good. So I don't know what are you going to say when one South African says, in addition to the current bidding process, you want another one next year. And then we listen to another one says, stop this one off this day. We go into court. Greenpeace?
Thank you, Portfolio Chair. And good morning, Sanbonani, members of the Portfolio Committee and members of the public and interested stakeholders and all other protocols observed. My name is Happy Kambude from Greenpeace Africa. And I am here to just give you a snippet of what our actual submission contains. The submission we sent to you as the portfolio committee was also quite condensed because we knew that you would have a lot of other information, but we saw fit that instead of giving the more technical and analytical analysis, we should give a more human face to the discussion, because what we tend to get lost in, and I really like the fact that you saw the CER as well as the land organization submission or other presentations, is that there's a human element to this. This is how we can distill all this information into how we represent it at a human level. So as Greenpeace, we do a number of campaigns, we do a number of things, and a lot of the things that we do is around making sure that the social justice and environmental justice issues are not lost in the discussion, because things get really technical really quickly. We've got the capacity to do the same as any other organization in terms of the analytical work, but we also don't forget that we are citizens. We live in a country that is faced with many challenges. So likewise, when Greenpeace felt that the IRP was not coming in time. There was a time when the IRP was supposed to come in 2013. We had an IRP draft IRP, which vanished. And then we kept on campaigning to say, well, we're having electricity increases. We're hearing that things are being built. We're hearing that things are not being built. Where is this instrument which determines how things are built, at least in the electricity sense? We then started lobbying and making actions around bringing out the IRP because it's quite important. Then 2015 came, 2016 came, we got another IRP after a few more years of lobbying. And then they said, no, it's going to come at the end of 2016. Nothing happened. Okay? We still continued with the drive of saying we really need this thing. Then 2017 came, we got an IRP 2017-2018. But before it came out, we got so many promises, beautiful promises about it's going to come out, and this is what the process is going to be. And then we saw fit that, you know what, we need to intensify our messaging around the need for an IRP. Then in August this year, when we were unable to locate the IRP on the website, nor to get information from the department about when the IRP is coming out, because the minister had promised us that it would be in August, we made this action in Mandela Bridge, trying to show the severity of the fact that we need an IRP, but also that the IRP in itself cannot have certain things. Certain things in the IRP cannot be in there because we've agreed, not only as a country, not only as a society, but as a global community, that we don't need them anymore. And one of those main things is coal. So this action is at Nelson Mandela Bridge, where we had climbers who put up a big banner which says, more coal, more deaths, no water. We're trying to link the fact that if we're increasing our greenhouse gas emissions, just like the land rights organization had eloquently put out, is that if you increase emissions, you're increasing the impact on ordinary South Africans. And one of those impacts is the severity around how much water is available through rain or through piped water that comes through. As we know, Cape Town and the Western Cape area, Eastern Cape and Northern Cape, are not the only areas that have drought conditions. Even in Johannesburg, as we speak, we're still under level one water restrictions. If you remember that 3 years ago, we had big, big droughts in Johannesburg, maybe not in the sense of saying that it's only localized in Johannesburg, but it also had impacts on the water reserve that we had in Lesotho. So Greenpeace's action is basically saying that if you're going to use water to generate electricity, make sure that you're not using the thing that uses the most amount of water. We've got things that don't use any water, or at least a little bit of water, compared to coal. We see water as a human right. We do not see it as a privilege. So if we're going to be developing our electricity sector the way we believe we're going to be developing it, let us remove the things that infringe on our human rights. Coal is one of them. It takes up a lot of water, and the negative externality of coal, meaning because it contributes to climate change, it contributes to the use of water, not only in mining as well as in the power generation, we should not use it anymore. This is some of the activities that we've been doing around the country. This is an example in Johannesburg, but we also have them here in Cape Town as well. It's graffiti that basically tries to communicate to the public to remember that water is a right. We should do everything we can to protect water. In terms of the work that we've also been doing around the water crisis, as you can see attached to the submission, there's a comic book that we've designed. It's a comic book for not only high school kids, it's also for universities and for people to understand that the issue of water is far bigger than just who uses it. It's about whether or not you get access to it and what kind of water you get access to for how long. We also work on nuclear issues. One of the key elements of the IRP is that it excludes new built nuclear until 2037 or thereabouts. But we are very happy that until up to 2030 there is no nuclear, because even with the nuclear built program that we have right now, which is that one power station, what we have is the associated nuclear liability has not been changed since the 1960s, 1970s, meaning that the amount of money that is associated to any risk around nuclear has not been changed, so it's under-accounted. So what that means is that what we have done is that we've been partitioning the Department of Environmental Affairs to change the amount which is determined for nuclear liability for the nuclear sector, particularly for Kuberg and Pelindaba. That process has been undergoing, although it has taken a step back due to the fact that the late minister has passed away, but we are still petitioning for the regulations to change. It is an ongoing process, and it's through the judicial process right now where we are looking to see that determination is made up different. This is another example of an action that we did inside the Department of Environmental Affairs last year. So the type of actions that we do is not only political, it's not only policy, but it's also campaigning at a grassroots level. The actions that we do there show the severity of the situation when we cannot get access to the people that we really need to talk to inside the department or the decision makers. But they also communicate the severity of the situation. Coming closer to home right now here at the PCE, Greenpeace, within the submission, would like to state that for the PCE to do its work, it needs to do its work beyond the finalization of the IRP. We are very happy with the fact that the PCE has taken this step in looking at the IRP and looking at getting public comments. What we would like to also infer and reinforce is that after the IRP has been determined and has been finalized or promulgated, whatever language is used, the PCE has an extra step to take,
meaning the implementation of the IRP needs to have an oversight role, which the PCT plays. When it says that it's about, when the IRP or the determination is made under the IRP around what is supposed to be built, when it is supposed to be built, what benefits it has, that, all of that should be done under the work of the PCE. In fact, what we also believe is that the portfolio committee can also actually instruct the Department of Energy to essentially tell us what is the process that's going to happen post the commenting period. Because what we have right now, just like with the other IRPs, is that we have a situation where we have everything up to the determination of the, until the finalization of the IRP. We don't know what happens after that. We know what has happened since the 2010 one, things vanished. So we would like that certainty that the process will happen in a particular way, and what are the necessary steps until maybe, let's say, the first few build programs. In terms of one of the main points around public participation, the Greenpeace would like to state that the Parliament as an organ, as an institution, needs to support grassroots organizations to come to Parliament to give oral presentations. It's very different for an organization like Greenpeace to come here because we've got a way in which we fundraise. Some organizations don't have the ability to fundraise the way we can, or don't have the financial resources that other organizations have. So grassroots organizations, CBOs, need support to come to, and give oral presentations because their dynamic is also different. Very different from an NGO's, which is an international NGO or an already established NGO, but CBOs have a different take altogether. Specific to our submission, we would like to say that the Department of Energy needs to reconcile the latest scientific understanding around climate change. The latest report, which CER, Center for Environmental Rights, spoke about, basically alluded to the fact that the IPCC has come out with new information and a new understanding and greater clarity around the impacts of climate change and how far we can push the need to respond to climate change. Luckily, South Africa has been responding to climate change in various ways, but that response has been twofold. One, it has been inadequate. Number two, it has been very schizophrenic. One day we are not building coal, the other day we're building coal. One day there's renewables, the next day I know there's a problem with renewables. But the point of the matter is that it's schizophrenic. We don't know, we don't have stability, honestly speaking, because we're not sure what is the process. So in terms of the oversight role that the PCE needs to play, is to make sure that we don't have the schizophrenia, we don't have this instability, the oversight of what decision has been made is carried through, the monitoring and evaluation thereof. In terms of the IPCC, it basically states that at a top line is that climate change is happening, climate change has been affecting people, but also that we don't have as much time as we thought to deal with it because it's getting really bad. We know it's getting really bad because we felt it in South Africa, and we're not the only ones who felt it. Namibia has felt it, Lesotho has felt it, the Southern African region has felt it. In fact, the IPCC points not only with this report, the special report, but the other reports to show that Southern Africa is one of the most vulnerable areas, including South Africa, because we're in Southern Africa, again, is one of the most vulnerable areas in the world due to climate change. And the reason for all of this is not necessarily because South Africa alone is one of the biggest emitters. No, it's because, unfortunately, we are stuck in a particular place, and we don't have the necessary capabilities as a region. However, because of the drought-like conditions, in this place, it makes it even more hard when climate change hits us, because we will have less water and we'll have further desertification, that occurs. In terms of what has happened, when we talk about the drought conditions that have happened in South Africa, at least, or maybe the impacts of climate change, is that there's two ways in which we've seen climate change happen in South Africa. And I'll link it back to coal later, but I think other organizations have done that even better than I have right now. The two impacts that we've had, and which are also announced in the IPCC, is essentially that the availability of water will be less, and when water comes, it will be a lot at once. at one point in time. If Lekakopola, at one point in Johannesburg, there was what we call rain bombs, where rain just falls in one particular area, non-stop for a period of time. It even got to a point where one of our greatest infrastructure, the OR Tambo, was underwater. Even the parkings, if you guys remember that. That whole thing is as a result of the severity, or rather the extremeness of weather events as a result of climate change. The scientists tell us this, and we can't run away from these facts. But at the same time, we were complaining a few days before that, that we don't have water, we're at level 4 restrictions at the time in Johannesburg. Now we're here in Cape Town. In Cape Town, in the Western Cape and in the Northern Cape, there's drought-like conditions. The water levels here are 76%, 73%, depending on who you call, but the Department of Water and Sanitation says it's 76%. If it continues like this, there will be less water available every year. And we know what that means. It means the water that has been used for home use, industry, and agriculture will be less. But the way in which the city or the municipalities, as well as the provinces, deal with this is to increase prices for things, particularly for water. So you stop people from using water when water is less available, but people need to use water, so people need to pay more. But businesses also do that. They also pay more for water, meaning that prices for almost everything goes up. Now we're in a situation where, right now in South Africa, we've got petrol increases, as well as a result of using coal, and there's water, and the problems around Eskom, we've got electricity increases. When do we get a chance to breathe? We can't breathe now. Increases are going up all the time. So let's rather think about that. But fundamentally, the problem relates in this aspect around the use of a particular fossil fuel. And we're not saying that it's been bad all the time. We didn't know. There are things we always learn about. We didn't know about the fact that Pluto is no longer a planet, I guess. When I was in school, Pluto was a planet. Now it's no longer a planet. I believe when you were in school and when I was in school, greenhouse gas emissions were not a big thing, right? It was still somewhere in the ether, somewhere else. But now science has progressed to such a point where it's telling us, like, look, it is actually a problem. And one of the key things that are causing this is oil and coal, not excluding gas, of course. So just to be quick and to finish off, in terms of the coal issue within the IRPs, that the IRP doesn't reconcile the need that South Africa has signed on to the Paris Agreement, and the land rights organizations touched on this. But the mechanics of the Paris Agreement dictates that when you give a contribution, that contribution must increase over time. Not meaning your coal increases, no, the amount of greenhouse gases must decrease. So it's kind of like a bit of an upside-down thing when it goes to the international negotiations. Which basically means for South Africa, we can't build new coal, and we also have to think about Kusile and Mudupi Unit 5 and 6, which are not already in operation, not to be fulfilled, not to be actually commissioned further or to be curtailed or to be stopped right now, because these are disastrous. I haven't touched on the issue, Sir Nalinzona, when we get to the coal communities where these plants are, where it's issues of health, it's issues of land segregation, it's issues of water availability and the quality of water. I'm not going to get to that because I think we can talk about that later at another point in time during the next your next term within the PCE. But the point which we're trying to get to right now is that the IRP is irresponsible if it includes new coal. We understand that there's already coal in the IRP that's been built in, but there's coal that can be removed and there's coal that is unnecessary. And that coal is Unit 5 and Unit 6 of Kusile and the new IPPs. As expertly explained by CER, we don't need those, and there are other legalities as well as economic factors which would necessitate us to remove these things. In terms of the IRP and Eskom, because it is a big question, people are always asking whether Eskom is the electricity sector or the electricity sector is Eskom. We feel that the IRP should, because we are right now in a state where the energy plan or the electricity policy of South Africa is a bit dicey. To give you an example, the last time we had an actual policy on electricity and on energy was in 1998. It was only there for 10 years. In 2008, we then got the act. We never got a new plan, a new policy. So now I'm also doing the problem. The problem is that we're also mixing the plan with policy. A plan is an instrument of policy. It is an instrument of a legislation. The CER showed us, or Center for Environment showed us, that the IRP is as a result of a provision within the Electricity Regulation Act. Our national energy policy now is no longer working because we have something that that necessitates energy planning and electricity planning, which is the National Energy Act. So we don't have a policy that gives us the IRP. We have an act that gives us the IRP, and we have an act that gives us an IEP. So what happens is that now ESCOM is working on the basis of a policy that's non-existent anymore, or rather that's not applicable anymore. We don't know what the role of ESCOM is going to be. We know that there's a process of an end state for ESCOM, but we need to understand that things have changed. We need to know whether or not ESCOM is going to start procuring renewables. We need to know whether ESCOM is going to be unbundled. We need to know all these nitty-gritty things about the electricity sector, because right now the electricity sector is synonymous with ESCOM. The IRP should at least give us some indication on that, because we don't have an electricity policy at this point in time, other than the ones that I've already spoken about, because the plan is not policy. The plan is an instrument of policy. In terms of the coal issue, as I've discussed, we do not need more coal beyond that which is already on the grid, and many of that needs to be decommissioned. What we've got right now from the ESCOM fleet is that it's aging, and you all know this because they always come and tell you that the coal fleet is aging. It's either they have to retrofit or decommission, but they will not decommission, they will maintain. They've kept on maintaining many of these power stations, but one of them right now just blew up, one of the units, Unit 5, got lit up. A few people got injured. Luckily, nobody died, unless I've got the wrong report. Second to that, Duva also had a silo collapse at one point in time, 2 years ago. A month ago, I believe it's Medupi, had also another fire. But that I'll single out because it was something that had to do with the manner in which they were doing work. Many of the power stations, including Matabo and Creel, have been undergoing systematic failures. The boilers are not working right. Some of the components cannot be replaced because they're too old. Many of these power stations that we have are old and are falling apart. We cannot keep them open for too long. People are going to die. We didn't know that people are going to get hurt. We thought that it was just an environmental issue that will result in maybe air pollution, people breathing badly. No, they're not really going to get it. But now it's direct. They're getting hurt at the power station. Things are exploding. Things are catching fire. People are getting hurt. These things are no longer safe. We don't need them if they're going to be killing our citizens. So I would believe that as a portfolio committee and as parliament, you'd be looking to either saying that these things should be safer, and if they cannot be safer, then they should be decommissioned and closed immediately, if not at a certain point in time. Luckily, the IRP kind of shows us a phase-out of some sort, but it's not really a phase-out, as we've heard, because it is increasing the coal capacity in essence. We've got a problem within the IRP around the diesel and gas issue. In the IRP, the Department of Energy did not disaggregate, or rather did not differentiate between gas and diesel. We know that diesel is one of the highest polluting and the most expensive forms of running electricity or generating power. Within the IRP, it is all coupled into one. It is all part of the gas allocation. I am open to being corrected, but there is nowhere in the IRP currently in the allocation table that says this is diesel, this is gas, this is open cycle gas turbine, this is closed gas cycle turbine, which means that there's a bit of fudging around the numbers. We are not happy when numbers are being fudged or when information around what is going to be built is not open, because it is open to misuse. Another problem around the IRP and the manner in which things are being determined is that we understand that there is another social, or rather, another political economy that gets developed when things are being procured. And that economy that is being developed is one that either necessitates rent seeking or necessitates good governance. What we've seen right now is that when there is an IRP, there's already repositioning around the economy that looks for rent seeking. And we would hope that any of these technologies, whether it's renewables, nuclear, gas and coal, do not have an element of rent seeking. Because the history that we have around coal is the one that we have around state capture. The history we have around gas and diesel is the one that we have around the initial reports around ESCOM's initial emergency procurement when they were having the war room discussions. And those war room discussions, when they resulted in open circle gas turbines and diesel peaking power plants having a greater share in order to deal with load shedding, there was some fudging, including the fact that the Denton's report, the SIU report, all of those reports pinpointed the fact that it all started, or rather, most of it started around the gas procurement. We do not run away from that. We do not run away from the issues that circulated around the nuclear space, and we're not running away from the fact of what is concerning the RE space right now with the need for transformation and et cetera. But what it necessarily means is that the IRP must necessitate good governance, meaning that we need to have a clear process that understands and determines and clearly identifies what is going to happen next. In terms of the presentation that I've given, I think I've given a lot of problems, and I'll give a few solutions to what has happened. In terms of Greenpeace, the way we've been working, as much as we're working at a national and provincial and local level, we also work at a grassroots level. We've been trying to deploy technologies around a community in Deep Sloot for a few years now. We wanted to electrify the streets because we don't have the capacity and the resources to electrify houses. So we chose to use solar in order to electrify the streets, because this area in Deep Sloot Extension 12 is not a nice place. If we know the reports, it's not a nice place, and I'm not going to lie about it. And what we saw is that maybe if we just make sure that the main avenues, the Tratase, Batbakenangosona, are cleaner, are better, are also well lit at night, then some of these problems will go away. And then maybe that will inspire local government to do something at a higher scale. Believe me not, the barriers that we got in order to just put on solar street lights was amazing. At this point in time, we were unable to put the solar street lights outside of a particular place. So the thing that we ended up doing is we chose one small crutch central to Extension 12. We put the solar street lights out in the property, yeah, the crutch, so that the area around the crutch, because most of the things are surrounding the crutch, there's a bit of economic activities around there, and there's a lot of traffic around there, at least it's lit. Because we were unable to get authorization from the city, nor get any support, at least in writing, from any of the departments. And we've been trying for years and years. And we got to a point where we just had to put solar panels on the crutch and then put some form of self-generation for the crutch to be able to work at night and during the day, because the crutch also serves as an adult education center. And this is how we did it. We also partnered up with one of the local NGOs as well in order to do this. But the fact of the matter is that we had an option of putting solar street lights not only for the safety of people in Deep Sloot, but also for the children and for majority, and honestly, majority for women in that area, as well as people who have been victims of certain crimes, including foreigners, so that it could be safe. But we couldn't do that in the whole area that we wanted. We had to go to a smaller area. And then we partnered, as I said, with an NGO and created some form of minuscule, nominal jobs, which could be upscaled at a higher level. But the summary that we have in terms of the presentation, sorry, not the presentation, but the submission that we gave, is that we should not forget universal access, meaning that everybody needs to get electricity, everybody needs to get water, everybody should get shelter. That is the main biggest thing. Universal access to services is very key. But doing that, we need to make decisions, and those decisions need to stick. We need policy and process certainty. Number three, in terms of the IRP in itself or the DOE, is that you need to remove the constraints on renewable energy. You need to reconcile what the IPCC says and how it aligns with our emissions profile in South Africa. And also, we need to understand that climate change is an urgent concern. It's no longer something that's going to happen in 2100. They used to say that in 2100 or 2050. No, it's happening today. And the severity of the situation is going to happen even more by 2030 if we continue the way we are going. We've seen that we've made decisions in this country where we just go and then we change our minds. We need certainty now. We need oversight, and we need to make sure that we're taking in the necessary information. And lastly, we need to understand how ESCOM's role is going to be affected by the IRP, especially when its developmental agenda is that everybody should get electricity by 2023. And we are far away from that. And some of the ways in which we can get everybody electricity is to employ these new technologies, which are now cost-effective. Thank you. Just to show the comic book. I forgot. It's really just a comic book that was created by one of our staff members in Greenpeace. And this child, Imani, is actually a real child. The story is not so real, but the child is real. And Imani is a real child from the staff members. It's attached to the presentation. And essentially, it chronicles her story to getting human rights and water intertwined as one, and the government recognizing water as a human right. The Department of Energy would know, as all other departments, that we went on to each and every department and delivered this petition. Unfortunately, when I did deliver this petition to the Department of Energy, I delivered the petition at the round table which we had the last time the department had an outreach program on the IRP, on the future of the energy mix in South Africa. And we're still hoping that Imani, the real child, will deliver the petition to the president at the end of this year. So, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Kind please. Mr. Kambul. Okay, I thought you were going to start a song. We have to break now. We thought maybe we can get the next presentation. Just break. Bello is still here. No fudging, eh? No rent-seeking. Honourable members, should we break now, or do we have any questions between now and 1 o'clock? If not, we can actually break. Now Matela proposes that we break. Let us be back here at 2 o'clock. Yes, the next presenters will only be here after lunch. So let's be here at 2 o'clock. The meeting is adjourned. See you at 2.